Episode 5, Whitby by the Sea. Jonathan Harker has traveled to Transylvania and become a prisoner in Castle Dracula. Meanwhile, Count Dracula plans his journey to England. Our story now returns to England. In Whitby by the Sea, Lucy Westenray awaits the arrival of her dear friend, Mina Murray, Jonathan Harker's fiancée. But just now, at a London insane asylum, Dr. John Seward records the admission of a new patient.
R.M. Renfield, etat. Sanguine temperament, great physical strength, morbidly excitable, periods of gloom ending in some fixed idea which I cannot make out. I presume that the sanguine temperament itself and the disturbing influence end in a mentally accomplished finish. Possibly dangerous man. Probably dangerous, if unselfish. In selfish men, caution is as secure an armor for their foes as for themselves.
Letter from Mina Murray to Lucy Westenray, May 30th.
My dearest Lucy, I am overjoyed with your letter. The news of your engagement fills me with happiness. I shall expect a full report upon my arrival in Whitby. I have just had a few hurried lines from Jonathan from Transylvania. He is well and will be returning in about a week. I am longing to hear all his news. It must be so nice to see strange countries. There is the 10 o'clock bell. Goodbye. Your loving Mina.
The case of Renfield grows more interesting the more I get to understand the man. He has certain qualities very largely developed. Selfishness, secrecy, and purpose. I wish I could get at what is the object of the latter. He seems to have some settled scheme of his own. But what it is, I do not know. His redeeming quality is a love of animals, though indeed he has such curious turns in it that I sometimes imagine he is only abnormally cruel. His pets are of odd sorts. He has at present such a quantity of flies that I have had myself to deal with the matter. Mr. Renfield, may I speak with you?
One moment, please. Yes, doctor?
Did you just eat a fly? Mr. Renfield, I forbid you to eat flies.
Oh, but, doctor, you must understand that to eat the fly is very good and very wholesome. It is life, strong life, and gives life to me.
Be that as it may, you are forbidden to eat flies. As a matter of fact, I've come to speak to you regarding these flies of yours. They have become a bit of a nuisance. Lord knows there are enough flies in this place without your putting scraps of food at the window to attract more.
May I have 3 days? I shall clear them away.
I suppose that would be all right.
After 3 days, I return to Renfield's cell. To my amazement, he has turned his mind now to spiders, and he has got several very big fellows in a box. He keeps feeding them with his flies, and the number of the latter is becoming sensibly diminished, although he has used half his food in attracting more flies from outside to his room. His spiders are now becoming as great a nuisance as his flies, and today I told him that he must get rid of them.
You see, Mr. Renfield, to you these spiders are pets, but to everyone else they are a rather unattractive bother.
Yes, yes, of course.
What is that you're writing?
Totals. Lives do add up, you know.
Let me see that. What are these numbers?
My accounts.
What was that? Is that a sparrow? Mr. Renfield, really, now you've got a sparrow?
Just one.
How on earth did you attract a sparrow?
With spiders.
I see. There is a method in Renfield's madness. He had managed to get a sparrow and tame it. His means of taming is simple, for already the spiders have diminished. Those that do remain, however, are well fed, for he still brings in the flies by tempting them with his food. He has now a whole colony of sparrows, and his flies and spiders are almost obliterated. When I came in, he ran to me and said he wanted to ask me a great favor.
A very, very great favor.
And what might that be?
A kitten. A nice little, sleek, playful kitten that I can play with and teach and feed.
But wouldn't you rather have a cat than a kitten?
Oh, yes, I would like a cat. I only asked for a kitten lest you should refuse me a cat. No one would refuse me a kitten, would they?
I'm afraid, Mr. Renfield, that at present I fear it would not be possible.
Oh, Doctor, please, I implore you. My very salvation depends upon it.
I am sorry, but I must refuse. I shall return tomorrow, and I trust that you will have diminished these animals to a proper number. I must remind you, Mr. Renfield, that you are in an asylum, not a zoo.
Exclusive 2, The Daily Telegraph, August 8th. One of the greatest storms on record has just been experienced here, with results both strange and unique. Yesterday, shortly before 10 o'clock, the stillness of the air grew quite oppressive. Without warning, the tempest broke. The waves rose in growing fury, till in a very few minutes, the lately glassy sea was like a roaring and devouring monster. White-crested waves beat madly on the level sands and rushed up the shelving cliffs. Others broke over the piers and with their spume swept the lanterns of the lighthouses, which rise from the end of either pier of Whitby Harbor. The wind roared like thunder and blew with such force that it was with difficulty that even strong men kept their feet or clung with grim clasp to the iron stanchions. Here and there a fishing boat, with a rag of sail running madly for shelter before the blast. Now and again, the white wings of a storm-tossed seabird. On the summit of the east cliff, the Whitby searchlight was made ready and soon swept over the surface of the sea. Before long, the searchlight discovered, some distance away, a schooner with all sails set. Between her and the port lay the great flat reef, and with the wind blowing from its present quarter, it would be quite impossible that she should fetch the entrance of the harbor. Then came a rush of sea fog, a mass of dank mist, which seemed to close on all things like a gray pall, and left available to men only the organ of hearing. The wind suddenly shifted to the northeast, and the remnant of the sea fog melted in the blast, and then between the piers, leaping from wave to wave as it rushed at headlong speed, swept the strange schooner before the blast with all sails set and gained the safety of the harbor. The searchlight followed her, and a shudder ran through all who saw her, for lashed to the helm was a corpse with drooping head, which swung horribly to and fro at each motion of the ship. No other form could be seen on deck at all. A great awe came on all as they realized that the ship, as if by a miracle, had found the harbor, unsteered save by the hand of a dead man. But, strangest of all, the very instant the shore was touched, an immense dog sprang up on deck from below, as if shot up by the concussion, and running forward, jumped from the bow on the sand, making straight for the nearby churchyard, and disappeared among the ancient flat tombstones. Not often can such a sight have been seen. The dead man was simply fastened by his hands, tied one over the other, to a spoke of the wheel. Between the inner hand and the wood was a crucifix, the set of beads on which it was fastened being around both wrists and the wheel, and all kept fast by the binding cords.
20 July. Visited Renfield very early, before the attendant went his rounds. Found him up and humming a tune. He was spreading out his sugar, which he had saved in the window, and was manifestly beginning his fly-catching again, and beginning it cheerfully and with good grace. I looked around for his birds, and not seeing them, asked him where they were. He replied, without turning round, that they had all flown away. There were a few feathers about the room, and on his pillow a drop of blood. I said nothing, but went and told the keeper to report to me if there were anything odd about him during the day. The attendant has just been to me to say that Renfield has been very sick and has disgorged a whole lot of feathers. Apparently he has eaten his birds. My homicidal maniac is of a peculiar kind. I shall have to invent a new classification for him and call him zoophagus or life-eating maniac. What he desires is to absorb as many lives as he can, and he has laid himself out to achieve it in a cumulative way.
Mina? Oh, Mina, I'm here.
Oh, Lucy, dear.
Mina, I'm so happy to see you. There's so much to tell you.
And I insist upon hearing every last word.
Come along. Whitby has the quaintest little cafe. We'll have tea and toast while I tell you the news. And you must tell me of Jonathan and this great adventure of his.
Now, tell me everything about him.
Mr. Homewood, he's the Honorable Arthur Homewood, only son of Lord Godalming, is coming up here very shortly, as soon as he can leave town, for his father is not very well, and I'm counting the moments till he comes.
A lord, no less.
It's only proper, don't you think?
And how is your mother?
Oh, you must not listen to mother. I dare say she expects that some night I will rise from my bed and walk off the seawall.
Lucy, you shock me.
Oh, it's nothing, really. Only that the sea air has revived my childhood habit of sleepwalking.
We must be careful.
Of course we will. Now, what news do you have from Jonathan?
I'm beginning to worry, Lucy. Just yesterday, dear Mr. Hawkins, who is always so kind, sent me a letter from him. It is only a line dated from Castle Dracula, and says that he is just starting for home. That is not like Jonathan. I do not understand it, and it makes me uneasy.
What do you mean, uneasy?
I don't know, really. Why do you ask?
Well, it's just that lately I've had a strange feeling, a sense of impending darkness coming over everything.
Journal, August 9. Still no news from Jonathan. It is 3 weeks since his letter to Mr. Hawkins, and I have become quite worried. And now the weather has turned and added to the overall gloom. Last night was very threatening, and the fishermen say that we are in for a storm. Everything is gray, except the green grass, which seems like emerald amongst the earthy rock. The sea is tumbling in over the shallows and the sandy flats with a roar. The horizon is lost in a gray mist. All is vastness. The clouds are piled up like giant rocks, and there is a brool over the sea that sounds like some presage of doom. Dark figures are on the beach here and there, sometimes half shrouded in the mist. The fishing boats are racing for home and rise and dip in the groundswell as they sweep into the harbor.
Mina Murray's Diary, August 9th, 3 a.m.
I fear for Lucy's life. From the depths of sleep, I suddenly became broad awake and sat up with a horrible sense of fear upon me and of some feeling of emptiness around me. I lit a match and found that Lucy was not in her bed, so threw on some clothes and went through the house looking for her. Coming to the hall door and finding it open, I took a big heavy shawl and ran out. The clock was striking one as I was in the crescent and there was not a soul in sight. I ran along the north terrace, but could see no sign of the white figure which I expected. At the edge of the west cliff, above the pier, I looked across the harbor. As a cloud passed, I could see the ruins of the abbey coming into view. And as the edge of a narrow band of light, as sharp as a sword cut, moved along, the church and the churchyard became gradually visible. And there, on our favorite seat, the silver light of the moon struck a half-reclining figure, snowy white. The coming of the cloud was too quick for me to see much, for shadow shut down on light almost immediately. But it seemed to me as though something dark stood behind the seat where the white figure shone, and bent over it. What it was, whether man or beast, I could not tell. I did not wait to catch another glance, but flew down the steep steps to reach the east cliff. When I got almost to the top, I could see the seat and the white figure, for I was now close enough to distinguish it even through the spells of shadow. There was undoubtedly something, long and black, bending over the half-reclining white figure. I called in fright, "Lucy! Lucy!" And something raised a head. And from where I was, I could see a white face and red gleaming eyes. Lucy did not answer, and I ran on to the entrance of the churchyard. The church was between me and the seat, and for a minute or so, I lost sight of her. When I came in view again, the cloud had passed, and the moonlight struck so brilliantly that I could see Lucy half reclining with her head laying back over the seat. She was quite alone, and there was not a sign of any living thing about. When I bent over her, I could see that she was still asleep. Her lips were parted and she was breathing, not softly as usual with her, but in long, heavy gasps, as though striving to get her lungs full at every breath. As I came close, she put up her hand in her sleep and pulled the collar of her nightdress close around her throat. I woke her gently, and we made our way home without meeting a soul. The next day, Lucy made no mention of our adventure by the sea, but soon after breakfast excused herself and went out. I followed and watched as she went to the very bench where I had found her the previous night. I joined her and sat.
Oh, hello, Mina.
Lucy, may I ask, did you dream at all last night?
I didn't quite dream, but it all seemed to be real. I only wanted to be here, in this spot. I don't know why, for I was afraid of something. I don't know what. I remember passing through the streets and over the bridge. I heard a lot of dogs howling. The whole town seemed as if it must be full of dogs, all howling at once. Then I had a vague memory of something long and dark, with red eyes, just as we saw in the sunset, and something very sweet and very bitter all around me at once. And then I seemed sinking into deep green water, and there was a singing in my ears, as I have heard there is to drowning men. And then everything seemed passing away from me. My soul seemed to go out from my body and float about the air. I seemed to remember that once the West Lighthouse was right under me. And then there was a sort of agonizing feeling, as if I were in an earthquake. And I came back and found you shaking my body. I saw you do it before I felt you.
Then she began to laugh. It all seemed a little uncanny to me, and I listened to her breathlessly. I did not quite like it, and thought it better not to keep her mind on the subject. So we drifted on to other subjects, and Lucy was like her old self again. When we got home, the fresh breeze had braced her up, and her pale cheeks were really more rosy. Her mother rejoiced when she saw her, and we all spent a very happy evening together.
August 19.
Strange and sudden change in Renfield last night. About 8 o'clock, he began to get excited and sniff about as a dog does when setting. The attendant was struck by his manner, and knowing my interest in him, called for me. Good evening, Mr. Renfield. Have we nothing to speak of this evening?
I don't want to talk to you. You don't count now. The master is at hand.
I see you've begun your little zoo again. I say, may I see your spiders? I trust you've got some large fellows.
Bother them all. I don't care a pin about them.
What? You don't mean to tell me you don't care about spiders?
The bride maidens rejoice the eyes that wait the coming of the bride. But when the bride draweth nigh, then the maidens shine not to the eyes that are filled.
The mystery grows. Renfield would not explain himself, but remained obstinately seated on his bed all the time I was with him. Returning to this office, I had lain tossing about and had heard the clock strike only twice when the night watchman came to me, sent up from the ward to say that Renfield had escaped. The attendant was called by the sound of the window being wrenched out, saw that the cell was empty, and had at once sent for me. At Renfield's cell, I saw the torn window casement, and looking out, could see in the distance our patient scaling the high wall which separates our grounds from the grounds of Carfax, the deserted estate which stands along our property. Crossing the wall and dropping down on the other side, I could see Renfield's figure just disappearing behind the angle of the house. So I ran after him. On the far side of the house, I found him pressed close against the old iron-bound oak door of the chapel. He was talking, apparently to someone. Drawing near, I heard him say,
I am here to do your bidding, master. I am your slave, and you will reward me, or I shall be faithful. I have worshipped you long and afar off. Now that you are near, I await your commands, and you will not pass me by, will you, dear master, in your distribution of good things? They come for me now, but I shall be patient. I await your command.